only do is that one, right?
Mm-hmm. Red button. When the red light comes on, we're good.
Okay.
I guess we're good.
Alright.
Here we are.
Here we are, March 21st, 2012. We're going to call our meeting to order here for the Home Occupancy Tax Amendment, Article 92 Subcommittee. And David, what do you have?
Well, first I thought I'd start off with just a summary of issues. And Valerie has forwarded a revised draft ordinance. We also have a outline of that ordinance that she passed out at the beginning of the meeting, which kind of helps go through the issues. But I just wanted to do a quick recap. Article 92 is the existing county home occupation code. The Board of Commissioners and staff and some home occupation permit holders have been wanting to see some changes for quite a while. This committee was formed by the Planning Commission at the direction or at suggestion of the Board of Commissioners. We've talked about doing a draft ordinance, changes to the ordinance that would employ a type 1, 2, and 3 procedure. That was in some previous meetings. We talked about ministerial versus quasi-judicial permits. Ministerial are generally objective in nature. Quasi-judicial are subjective. The type 1, 2, and 3 process is kind of getting ahead of a bit of a process that we want to employ throughout the RLDC. We recently met with Commissioner Haugen, who's the liaison to this department, and discussed doing type 1, 2, and 3 procedures elsewhere in the code. So actually, we're kind of breaking ground on that process. So one of the things that Valerie and I have been looking at in constructing the draft ordinance is looking ahead a bit as to what to anticipate in that typing procedure. Now, in terms of home occupation ordinance adoption, this is the fourth meeting of this committee, and we'd like to either wrap it up tonight or maybe one more meeting, or maybe even email out document with some sort of confirmation before we go to the Planning Commission and a workshop. I've tentatively scheduled a workshop for this ordinance with the Planning Commission chair, Don Moore. The other day we met, and we're looking at April 30th to go to the Planning Commission. This subcommittee, and Ward is the Planning Commission liaison to the committee and chair here, you then present the code to them, walk them through it like we have done other workshops, kind of hit the high and low points and everything in between, and if the Planning Commission so desires, then they'll take the issue to a public hearing, hopefully in May. So we should have something pretty quick there, and then the process is the Planning Commission reviews ordinance language, they review a text amendment. They are essentially the final decision maker for that. Now, they have to be adopted by the board, but the way the code reads is the board is a review body at the second hearing. The final decision is really made by the Planning Commission, and the board is pretty much limited to some minor tweaks when they adopt the ordinance. If they don't like it, they can simply refuse to adopt it, send it back to the Planning Commission, and restart over again. Or they could remand it to the Planning Commission with some specific direction about portions of the ordinance that they are uncomfortable with. But essentially, what we try to get, that's the reason we do the workshop, is to make sure that the Planning Commission is, I don't know if that's open, is it?
It is.
That the Planning Commission is comfortable with, with the ordinance as written, and that's the way it'll go to the board. So that's kind of a summary of where we're at. Valerie's done some good work on the ordinance. Again, she has this outline for you to read. And we also made copies of ORS 215-448. And that is primarily focused on the farm zones and forest zones. And what other materials do you have?
I have an outline of the our grid, because that's what we did. It's a copy of what we did up on the board as a group, and so I was trying to show the input that I used when I was trying to put the code together as far as whatever circle is pretty much what I put into it. And then if I altered it because it just made sense or because we didn't have agreement on something specific, I noted it in there. Just to give you guys an idea of how much of your input went into making this ordinance.
Okay, I don't have a copy.
I'm
putting
things together for you.
Okay,
I can't do two things at once.
You can't.
I'm alive. So why don't we move to item? That's pretty much my summary of the issues. And Vivian walked in a little late, so didn't hear my description of the process after this goes to the Planning Commission with recommendations. I can explain it to you later.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will tell you that we are looking at April 30th as a workshop with the Planning Commission, so we'd like to have the subcommittee's work done in time to send that to the Planning Commission. Generally, we have to notice that meeting 10 days before it, so we have to know for sure we're going to hold that workshop by April 20th, and I usually pick that date as well to send them any material. So I'd like to have our work done by April 20th at the latest, so I can send it to them. So, revised draft ordinance and all that. Valerie kind of walk you through. You're going to use the outline as a guide first, or
actually,
thank you for sending it out.
You're welcome. The outline is more specific to the application, the time, and the cost. So I don't know if we want to do that separately.
I think separately. Why don't you go through the ordinance first?
Okay. The applications and what do they look like?
We don't have the applications. We have an outline for application.
All right.
Okay, but we won't do that one now. Okay. First.
We're going to go through this first?
We're going to go through the draft first.
Okay. This one. Stand.
Stand. Here. Okay. So, typical of an article or an ordinance, we discuss, you know, the purpose of the ordinance first, kind of give the reason that it's needed, and we have two there, so if you want to pick your favorite. my thought is that if there's anything specific that you really have an issue with, we can, of course, discuss it tonight, but it might be best to put it in writing. Specify the actual piece of code that you have a problem with and explain why, and then email it to me. And that way it's on the record and I have it to consider. So I make sure that I know what your opinion is instead of trying to write it down in my words.
I like the first paragraph. It's more user-friendly.
Okay.
That's mine.
And then authority. Referenced in there is our ORS and just a basic description of what should occur on the property without this type of ordinance review, or without the review. I apologize. I have not had good sleep for two nights, and so I'm bumbling. Okay, so then we go into a general definition and criteria, and that's basically this criteria would apply to all of the home occupations. The definition is something that will also go into Section 11.030, which is the part of the code that we put all definitions in. So it's something that we have to be real specific on, and we're still kind of shaping that up. I don't know if we've settled on this one or not. So
that first sentence of 92030A would be the definition.
Right. And then the criteria would be the numbered items following. So current noise ordinance, offensive vibration, basically impact, physical impact. And we have included the electrical interference if it affects, someone's lights are fluctuating or something like that. And then making sure that neighborhoods stay looking like a residential neighborhood, no exterior remodeling. And then addressing toxic or flammable materials. I don't think anybody really wants to deal with some strange toxic waste next door or some type of explosion. We do have a list that we received a couple of years ago from DEQ that's kind of just a checklist of different types of materials that can be used in different types of businesses. So we'll use that. that. We're going to use that for our home occupation software. All parking and signage will be on site, not in public right of way. That's a real important aspect of home occupation, that the parking is on site.
You say signage, does that include signage on vehicles?
No, no. That would be something on a structure or standalone.
Okay, are we going to address vehicles with signage on them?
So this is general criteria or standards that will apply to all of our home occupations. We will get more specific as we go through each type.
Okay.
I can answer that particular question, though. You paint your sign on the side of the vehicle and you park it near the street corner so everybody sees it. Is it a sign or is it a vehicle?
We don't regulate vehicles.
It's a vehicle.
Yeah.
Cool. So they can park it in the front yard, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the one. Driveway.
Yeah.
Driveway.
Yeah.
Still a vehicle.
Right.
Let's go to the Seattle and Renton with the fine ordinances for the commercial and retail areas. If the guy had a vehicle and he parked it in the very front parking space for the driveway, it wasn't considered part of his total square footage of signage. It was a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Home occupation shall be secondary to the residential use of the property. That basically means that you're going to be living there. It's not going to just be a commercial business. All home occupations other than those deemed exempt shall be administered as type 1, 2, or 3, and it's distinguished by potential impacts. Type 1, 2, and 3 will require a development permit as final authorization, and only the principal occupant of a residential property may run the home occupation. So that means that you can't come, you're not going to be the principal operator if you're not actually living on the property.
Right. Which is consistent with some LUBA decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
Just for your information, that's another filter that we run these through. I mentioned that in the last meeting, and I had a chance to go through. These are all LUBA cases that cite home occupations, that are relevant to home occupations. So I've kind of filtered this ordinance through these LUBA decisions and made sure that we're not in violation of any decision that's already been made.
What about, and then I'm just... Think about this, to run across a couple. What about somebody who has a piece of property that's set up as dual occupancy, two homes, and one of them decided to do a business and the other one he lives in?
Call that home occupation.
For the purposes of the ordinance, since you can do a home occupation in an accessory structure, that's probably how we treat that. And I believe the accessory structure ones are, did you make a distinction? Valerie?
I think it's...
Did they go to a type 2 if they're an accessory structure?
No, it's allowed in type 1 also, and even an exempt. It's specific to each type and exempt. And I think, too, that because we're looking at the property and the uses as a whole,
mm-hmm.
that as long as there is a residential use on the property, then I think you could consider that secondary still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I know there's a couple of cases where there's homes, and one of them is being used as a work area, the second home, and also where there's a space for a mobile home pad on that same property. So there is a permanent residence,
mm-hmm.
and there's also a mobile home pad, which is, so you can kind of go either way. Well, do I live in a mobile home, or do I live in the house, and is one of them a work area or not? So,
well, a pad, or is a mobile home?
Exactly, a pad. I mean, they have the legal pad on their property to have a mobile home along with their permanent residence. So, somebody was working out of one or the other, which that... And I heard just what you said, it could fall in any one of the categories.
Right.
As long as there is a permanent residence that is being used as residence.
Right. The only thing that we would be concerned about is that if there, because typically once you remove, this is getting off sideways, but once you remove a home off a property, you only have so much time to replace it.
Yeah, whether
right.
to go and
so. Okay.
Oftentimes, mobile homes were medical hardship permits.
Right.
And so they're a temporary dwelling. They're not a vested second
right.
dwelling in
right.
the property.
Well, see, we run across those questions that come in our office. So, well, you know, geez, I got this place. Can I do this? And I said, it's not to you. It goes to you guys.
Yeah.
But I've already heard that, you know, that they're
yep.
dual residents. You know,
so. And then we do have several properties in the county that have a couple of residences on it.
Like pre-code.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for exempt home occupations, overall, and I think we were in agreement on this throughout the meetings as we looked at impacts and then typing, that we were looking for that zero impact type, you know, you really don't know that they're doing a business
right.
next door. So
well,
that
a question came up, and I happen to see it on your chart here because Rick and I looked at it. We marked it number 4, which is deliveries to residents by parcel package, so it's only yet on your grid here, you've got parcel post. And that was a question that came up, the definition of parcel, a postal versus a UPS and FedEx.
So post and parcel, which I abbreviated there, would be UPS, the USPS, FedEx.
Okay.
So those are typical residential-type deliveries.
DHL, yeah, any of those. Parcel services.
Yeah.
Valerie, in the first draft, had UPS,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
businesses listed,
the
but because
code.
They're private businesses, we don't.
Okay.
I don't want to.
How about number 3? It says no customers should come to the property.
Right. For exempt home occupations, there's no
right.
customers.
Well, let me ask a question about that. Now, say you have a business that you've got, let's call it tenanting, and You normally go out to somebody's house and check it out. What if they want to come to your office and look at some books and look at types of fencing and see what type of fencing they
want? Well, if that's going to happen on a regular basis, then you should go for a type 1.
Okay, and how about a beauty salon in your garage?
Okay, we haven't gotten to that type yet. We're working our way from
okay.
the least from
yeah.
the least impacted.
Well, that's the customers coming into the...
Yeah, so we're working our way up. This is exempt. So this is one that you are not going to have to go through any type
okay,
of...
Okay, I see. I understand.
Okay.
And having your customers
like
would
that.
Make it, you wouldn't even know
right.
there
so
there
this
was
is,
a business there.
This is the home business that you aren't even sure if it's there or not.
Well,
okay.
This is like no one's
doing things on eBay.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah, sales rep that you know he comes and goes. And
or you keep
like
going
that.
To the...
There's
someone and...
There's no employees. There's no signs. There's no customers. You're only getting UPS or your typical residential type deliveries. You can have one business-related vehicle on site. Your storage of material is going to be interior or in an accessory structure. Interiors of the dwelling or accessory structure. You're only going to have 25% of the total square footage of the structure on the property. And you're not going to use the address of the home in any type of advertisement. So you're not going to be putting the address out there for anyone to accidentally stumble across. So when we go to the application process, basically it's going to be, we're going to try and make it an over-the-counter type of situation where we will have a checklist where they say, no, I'm not having customers on site, I won't have a sign. They agree to all of these standards listed above. They will sign a compliance agreement, which is basically going to be that checklist agreeing that they maintain that level of business on the property. We will keep that in a land use file as well as putting it on Laserfish so it's something readily available. So if someone called and said, I think there's a business next door, we'll say, well, yes, there is, but they're exempt as long as they're maintaining the camp. They can cut down on poor Nan having to run out all the time. And we won't be issuing a permit for this. It will simply be the checklist as well as just having it recorded in our files.
Okay, so I'd like to add a word in there since we're going through this. No development permit will be required or issued for exempt home occupations. So in other words, I understand it's not required.
I take your point.
You could probably use the word required instead of issued.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so then we move into type 1, which is going to be the business that is there, but it's nothing that really makes its presence an irritation. We hope. So it's
for all of them, we hope that, actually.
That's true. That's true. Well, it's something that you'll notice there's a business, but hopefully not any big, there's no big impacts. So there will be a review required, and the standards that they will be held to are that they can have 2 non-resident employees or volunteers, and that includes part-time. So that means somebody not living in the house. Mm-hmm. So if you and your husband and your son are conducting business together on the business, conducting business in the home, you can still have two other outside employees come in. Adequate on-site parking to accommodate both homeowners and employees. One non-illuminated exterior sign not to exceed 6 square feet in size. Customers and clients by appointment only. So rather than trying to regulate how many they have in a day, which would be rather difficult for us, this would be the type of thing where they're only going to have, they're not going to have people showing up randomly. It's like the person who's taking in taxes or the person who is doing hairstyling, that kind of thing. With a maximum of 3 on-site parking spaces. So that means they're not going to have more than 3 people at a time.
And the reality is, can we really regulate, playing the devil's advocate here, whether somebody's making appointments or not? Not really.
Yeah.
But that's more of an advisory clause. What really limits is the number of parking spaces.
Right. Can you really determine when you go out and look at the person's property, well, who's the client, who's the customer, and who lives there?
Well, if it comes...
You have to run their plates or something, you know?
Well, we're not in that business, but basically what it comes down to is if it is at a level where it starts creating a problem for a neighbor and they do decide to make a complaint and start a violation, there would have to be something that created NAN's proof.
Mm-hmm. There's got to be a threshold of some sort.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no violation.
Right.
And it helps in their minds shape, okay, what level am I? If they say, yeah, I'm going to have 10 customers a day, no, you're not a type 1.
Mm-hmm.
On the sign,
mm-hmm.
Are we going to enforce any kind of setback or where the sign can be? I mean, it doesn't really say, it says one non-only extent, not to see square feet, but can I put it right on the property line in the street?
Typically, when it comes to signs, we've used the commercial, typically residential properties have a 30-foot setback from the right of way. Mm-hmm. However, when it's come to signs in the past, the policy has been to allow it at 10 feet
okay.
from the right of way.
All right, so should we explain that in there, that the sign ordinance will apply?
Probably.
Does that mean?
You can make reference to the sign code.
Okay.
It's implied that's where we would go, but it's
good for them. We know that it's 10 foot, but I mean, the guy could say, okay, well, I'm going to put it right at the edge of my driveway in the road.
Well,
you know, so people can see it.
When they turn in their site plan, that's one of the things they have to show on the site plan. They have to show us the actual signage. This is my 2x3, and this, you know, and then they're going to show us on a site plan where that sign is going to be located.
Okay. So we should probably let them know that here, up front.
Yeah. Yeah. Just make reference to the sign code. One thing that you generally want to do in ordinance construction is just refer to other parts of your code where that has its own set of dimensional standards. Because if you decide later you want to change dimensional standards for all those kind of signs,
right.
For signage in general, mm-hmm. that's where you do it. And then everything that refers to it changes without having to change every portion.
Right, otherwise you have to go back and change 92 to 250 each time that you decide to change something.
And all the other portions of the code that refer to signs too. Yeah.
Again, delivery to the residents by postal package service only.
And that's the
UPS, FedEx, USPS. Two business-related vehicles. No outdoor storage or activities, no large equipment or commercial vehicles. So you're not going to have a backhoe, commercial-sized truck, equipment trailers, panel vans.
So when did that get decided? I'm not sure. I must have missed this.
So I'm not going to say that every single piece in here is exact from this. What I was trying to create is... looking at it also, not just from someone who's going into business, but looking at it from a neighbor. So that threshold of, okay, I have a little business next door, or I have
And that probably should say IE. And what we're after is what's considered heavy equipment, not normally.
You know.
What are you after, like the contractor's vehicles and what's
that? I think a guy that has a dump truck and a backhoe or an excavator, it should be under the type 1, because you know what? He's not impacting anybody's life. He's got a business. He goes away from his house every day, and he goes to work. you know,
but does he have room on the, you know, that he's not parking it or?
Well, I'll let you sort that out with your other committee members because they felt differently.
We could change it too because I have another standard for type twos, and so maybe we can draw from that.
Yeah, I see that down here, and it's if the guy has, you know, I think maybe I know it's his large equipment, but you know, if he has a dump truck and a dozer and a backhoe, that's really not. Not large equipment. It's not like big logging equipment and big loaders.
But it's not really residential.
Yeah, it's not what you're
And what I'm thinking of too, Ward, is that, you know, a lot of us live on five acre or larger parcels, but there are smaller subdivisions, and we've got to make this one size fits all to a certain extent. And it's not that those businesses are prohibited. It's just that they're done. They could be done at a different level, so that the 1 acre type. Parcels that might have someone parking a backhoe up against their fence because that's as much room as they have next to their home, and you know, every time.
I think that if you look under 10 at type 2, then you've got your large equipment commercial vehicles screened from view.
And I wonder if we could move like 10 up to, you know, here and do the same thing in that one.
I'm just thinking about a couple guys that are out where I live, and they're quarter acre property, and they got the big dually with a trailer in the back, and then they got the small Kubota or something on the back. I mean, he leaves in the morning, comes home at night, but the truck is parked there, you know, all the time on the weekends and everything else, and it's not hidden by any kind of visual
bushes
or anything else. So.
Do you wish it was?
Just remind me, because I know that's what he does for a living. So maybe one day I'm gonna have, hey, bring your little backhoe down, and I got a ditch in these things I got.
Sorry, what's a panel van mean?
Yeah.
Panel van. That would be like when you see like plumbers and they've got the racks with the racks on top, and there's no windows on it, and it's usually they'll have a business name on it, and it's basically filled with type, you know, tools and equipment.
Generally, panel vans are big enough to stand up inside.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what about them?
But the Econoline vans is up the same. You put that same category. Yeah.
Because I would rather not that be in there, because I do have a neighbor who's like 78 years old, he's been a painter for years, he's got 3 vans parked in a very adequate front yard and our driveway, and he even leaves lights on them inside at night to keep things from thawing or from freezing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't bother anybody, he's got a big hedge up, and you know, and if you put this in there and put panel vans.
Let's say that's an example, and again, it's not that it's not allowed. We're trying to create types with different types of impacts. So it's not that it's prohibited, it's just that at this level, it wouldn't be. And it would move to the next level. And as I said before, there are some parcels, I mean, some people are living on 5 to 10 acres. Some people live on 1 acre or less, and they're much more residential.
It's very residential.
You know, and there's some neighborhoods that really do not want any sign of a business at all. You know, so what I'm trying to do is create a balance between the being fair to business owners and being fair to property owners, so that once we cross that threshold where it starts looking more non-residential, where it starts, you know, you're very aware that there's a business next door, that there's some inputs and some mitigation measures in place to so they're not such an impact to the neighborhood. So there aren't issues between neighbors.
Sorry. Why don't we, rather than going through every, I'm looking at the clock here, rather than going through, and Nan has to leave at 8 on the button, rather than going through every one of these provisions.
Wow. It seems like forever.
I'm not thinking
through. No, we started early, didn't we?
I was going to say maybe call them out by number, and you can read them, and if there's any issues, rather than explanation of everyone. I mean, they're pretty short.
Yeah, so look at all of them.
Sure.
Can we remove panel vans from number 9?
It's not a problem. We wouldn't want to.
Okay. And if you want to read through permit procedures there, below that, and see where we're going.
Number 11 on A, Operations shall be conducted weekdays during typical business hours.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in this town work on Saturdays because they have to.
Right. But we're talking about residential neighborhoods when people are also trying to enjoy their residences.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. Yeah, I find no problem with this guy getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and taking off in his van.
Go ahead and, okay, the staff's just explaining what we've done. But your discussion, have it amongst yourselves. You guys are the subcommittee. So Nan and Vivian and Dave and Ward, you guys, you know, discuss what you want. But
okay. Ward, what do you think?
Well, you know, if they're not infringing on my residence and disturbing me,
no.
I don't have a problem with it.
No.
They operate all weekend long if they want. I don't care. As long as they don't bother me or make a noise or fumes or, you know.
Monday through Saturday.
How are we going to ensure that they don't do that?
Well, that's why they have a checklist here to say that, you know, you're not to infringe on my residence, you know, by firing guns at, you know what I'm saying, you know, noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, operation.
So I don't care. They can do whatever they want 7 days a week as long as they don't bother me. I'm okay with it, you know.
Yeah. Well, part of what we're after, again, in the type one is we've got to have those standards that aren't subjective. I mean, what you just explained is a subjective standard. It may bug you and it not bug you and it bugs me.
Right.
But if we've got a standard that's pretty, yeah, maybe it's Monday through Saturday.
That's
maybe it's, you know, another standard where we know exactly what it is. It's black and white. And then the type one, that's really our point.
Can we put Monday through Saturday there? Should we conduct it Monday through
consensus?
Saturday?
I don't
can
agree,
be.
But
how about instead of operation shells, it's can be.
Why are you saying Saturday? Do you have a business that you run on Saturday? Or?
No, my neighbor does. And he's a painter and he's 78 years old and he gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. Well, not Sunday, Saturday. He never works on Sunday.
But he doesn't have people come into his property.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't
impact the neighborhood. And so why? But I'm pretty sure he probably, because he has three.
Well, we wouldn't regulate him, though.
Well,
yeah, see, I'm just saying,
we're talking about the vehicle at the house in the evening
when they come home.
Well,
so
he has a couple of non-resident employees that park, like one of them parks on the street. Well, both of them do, actually. And he's got some things in here that you are going to regulate him, right, with type one. So in that type one.
But if he's a type two, then he's allowed by conditions of approval, which might be 7 days a week.
Okay, let's keep going.
Mm-hmm. Depending on the impact.
Okay, I'll put a question. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure.
Any other input on days of operation? Dave, what's your feeling on that?
You know, it's mixed emotions on it, because when we're talking about working out of a home and everything else, and we get to number nine, which all of a sudden changes it. We're talking about guys with big equipment and everything else. They're not going to be working on the weekends.
Well, they may.
But the vehicles aren't going to be there. They're not working at that place. Yet we're saying, well, you can't park your vehicle there because it's over 13,000 pounds. But the vehicle is going to leave the property. It's going to go someplace else. So they could be working 7 days a week. And there would be no impact of a business going on with that type of vehicle other than when he comes home and parks it.
Right. So what's the solution then, you think?
Strike number 11?
No.
Well, no, because we still have to, I mean,
regulate
that. I mean, there are certain businesses that are going to work that may impact the neighborhood because of traffic and or noise.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, like you said, that may all of a sudden, just because of those two things, throw them to a type 2. So I guess it's up for a
Is the solution within the type 1 language, or is the solution that you go to a type 2 if you're that kind of business?
Yeah, and it's because the level of review that we're putting a lot of these in type 2, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Not just impact, but the level of review and what they have to go through. So the more they have going on the property, the more review they need,
exactly.
And that's why you're in 2.
Exactly.
Not saying they can't have that, but more things are going to be required.
I mean,
what you have to keep in mind.
You can have, like, when Nancy, right,
mm-hmm.
the bookkeeper,
mm-hmm.
you can have her here, and she's got employees, she's got traffic coming on all day, and she also works during tax season 7 days
mm-hmm.
a week.
Yeah.
So that would automatically say, well, she's not type 1,
yeah,
she's type 2.
Yeah.
And in fact, she's
right.
not. She's really type 1.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, so here's the thing, though, too, is that although we can all sit here and say, well, that wouldn't bother me. We're writing the code for the whole county. and for other neighbors that might have different ideas of what is okay to them. And at a type two, we do public notice. And then they have the opportunity to say, I don't care. That's fine with me. But if there is a neighbor who's going to put up a stink later and there's going to be issues, it's better to get it out and have some mitigation measures in place before it is a problem.
Yeah, what if it's a shared driveway and she's got
exactly.
10 employees and they've all got, you know, right. every half hour they got people coming and people complain about, well, they're wearing down our road.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
Nancy's going to be a type 2, by the way. Nancy's a type 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she had moved from
there. She's got, yeah. what, 4 employees or...
Four.
Yeah, she's got 4. So she's a type 2 for this ordinance. Yeah. Right. Even though she's in the county, they're allowed.
But even what she just said about a shared driveway, there could be a 2 employees and customers coming,
mm-hmm.
and that would be, you know, all of a sudden, well, wait a minute, I need to question this. Why is there people coming and going?
It needs more of a review. They need right. to look at it more, so mm-hmm. it should be in a higher level.
I mean, I guess I'd go back years ago when we had, where we lived out on Monument Drive, and we had the blueberry patch. Property out there, shared driveway.
Mm-hmm.
But from September through August, I mean, it was coming traffic all the time, people coming out and getting blueberries.
So
but then the rest of the year, we never saw
them. Driveways.
So how do you, yeah, so how do you, you know,
include shared driveways?
Well, see, that's why it's here, because yeah. if they send a notice to the neighbors,
right.
then they'd be able to say, no, it's going to, we have a shared driveway, and it's going to, so see, that's why it's
next. And in crafting conditions of approval, that's where you can do things like recognize that there's seasonal use that's going to peak,
mm-hmm.
and then there's other times that it doesn't. I mean, a blueberry farm has absolutely zero impact in January,
mm-hmm.
but it's got a lot in August.
And the tax season has a lot
yeah.
in April.
Right,
mm-hmm.
and I think, you know, you could either regulate the accountants to say, you know, additional parking needs to be provided on site for peak periods such as tax season. There's your condition.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Or whatever.
Are we saying that 11 is still up for questioning? Or
I think it is. I think operations and census shall can be conducted Monday through Saturday during typical business hours. And what is a typical business hour, by the way? Who defines that?
Generally 8 to 5. We chose not to define it because people do like to switch it here by an hour or so.
Mm-hmm. 9 to 6.
Yeah, this guy gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning sometimes.
But he's out of there.
Well, I don't know because I'm an insomniac
yeah.
and I
yeah.
get up on my
computer. But he's out of there. But
wine seemingly.
And there are.
But 4 o'clock in the morning isn't typical business hours.
Mm-hmm.
If he was conducting business
on his property,
yes. Yeah.
And he has a panel van there.
And one thing that we could say, too, that would change the whole setup for your neighbor, if we were talking about him specifically, is we can say up to 2 non-resident on site. So if you have an employee showing up at your house and leaving with you in your panel yeah. van, then all of a sudden, you're exempt.
Yeah. Well,
or no, you're not, I'm sorry, you're not exempt.
Yeah.
Because
type
that's
one.
Nowhere.
That's
you would be a type 1.
But if they're not parking on the property... You know, and he's not conducting anything, doesn't have signs. I mean,
we can't write an ordinance that's going to necessarily capture every situation we
yeah.
can think of. Obviously, we try to you know, capture most of them, and the rest of them happen through conditions of approval or just advisory to the permit holder.
So we're not going to hassle my neighbor for leaving at 4 o'clock in the morning.
I don't know your neighbor.
Just because
you can leave anytime you want on that property.
Anyway, right?
Yeah.
No, can't.
Yeah. Okay, and number 9 we're going to leave as is, or are we going to change any of that?
We're going to take out panel van and put IE in front of backup.
That's recognizing that those kind of things would be covered under a type 2, and that's where you're looking at the property to see if it fits.
Right.
Okay, any other discussion on type 1, or should we move on to type 2?
I think we're type 2 right in.
Just want to read through yourself and then speak up when something
okay,
requires so comment.
Wow, square feet and size, well, that's pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah.
3 by 4?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's good enough for what this is. I mean,
oh, yeah. That's not very big. Okay.
Yeah. So it's adequate for
everybody. I'm thinking 12. This
yeah.
12 square feet.
Square.
Yep.
Well, piece of five is 32 square feet.
Geometry. Remember?
What?
Geometry. Remember?
No, I get it. Number six. Any commercial pickup and deliveries other than postal package services are limited to 2 per day. You gonna have somebody sitting out there counting it?
No.
No.
We don't have anybody verifying any of that stuff. It's on their honor and a guideline.
And if they break their conditions, unless there's a complaint from a neighbor, we're not gonna know.
Yep. You will have neighbors, if things get bad enough,
mm-hmm.
who will put a video camera out there, and sure enough, they're gonna give us the tape, and we're gonna see.
Call
you know.
Okay. And then I'm gonna be out.
But. Right. But it's
really
just to give a guide.
We're
yep.
What do you think, you guys?
Well, I mean, this dealing with UPS and FedEx as much as I do off and on, I mean, this two a day is really easy because they're going to make the delivery in the morning and they can come back on their pickup.
This is other than
postal
package.
Yeah.
Other
so people are going to interpret that as, oh, well, wait a minute, how come the UPS truck's coming all the time? We're saying commercial pickup, so. You know,
commercial size vehicles.
Commercial size.
This should be clarified.
Yeah, yeah. Something other than postal parking.
Right.
If you're doing appliance repair
mm-hmm.
and you're having a box van show up to haul them away or to drop them off, that would be other than UPS.
Other than UPS, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, 20-foot U-Haul kind of thing that comes in and drops off 3 or 4 large appliances to be fixed. Something like that.
We've got a mixed bag here of 2, 4, and 7, all related to vehicles. And so first off, we're saying adequate on-site for accommodating homeowners and employees. Then we say, oh, and you have to have enough to accommodate on-site parking for customers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say up to 4 related vehicles permitted on the property.
You want to combine those maybe?
Yeah,
I think
they ought to be combined.
Yeah.
Structurally? Yeah,
yeah,
that's a good comment. Makes sense. Number 9, on-site needs to be separated. It's 2 words. Or hyphenated.
Okay.
8, 2. And again, number 11, hours of operation allowed by conditions of approval. So for those folks that want to go Monday through Saturday or 7 days a week or later.
It's the same verbiage. I mean, put back up in under 1.
The only difference
number one,
is
we're not doing subjective conditions.
Right, and we don't have any input from the neighbors.
Right.
And Valerie and I kind of struggled with that too, because we thought about, well, we could call it 8 to 5. Yeah, that's got to get it. A lot of people work 7 to 6, and you know, home occupations, you may go as early as most business days start to as late as most business days end. It's 7 to 7 is probably the gap that fills most of them. But we wanted to get away from people that might have a couple of employees and run shifts. Because you know, people showing up for work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and work until 10 or 11 if there's a business that has any impacts at the property line is not appropriate for a residential area, is our thinking. So we didn't want to nail it down. That's why that phrase, even though it's a little loose to say typical business hours, most people have a general understanding what that is. And if Nanette gets a complaint that says, hey, somebody's working in their home oc until 11 o'clock every night, you know, use the reasonable person standard. Would a reasonable person say 11 o'clock at night is typical business hours? No, it's not. So.
I have a problem with vegetation at 8 and
you
9.
You do?
Yes.
You don't like trees?
Not in general. Just as they're required here. Because, like, one of the big violations, home occupation violations that I have, when I went out there and I got a complaint and went out there and he was non-compliant with several things, and one of them was he never planted the vegetation. And so I made him you know, go get some, and he got a rain check, and he's getting little plants. That's going to take years, and it's already been years that the neighbors have been staring at it because there has been no vegetation, and now he's going to plant little vegetation, so... You know, could we change that, require mature vegetation?
Well, we aren't landscape architects, but connect is not going to... Well,
and my intention was existing.
To screen it.
Right. And my intention was existing, you know, because a lot of... It's already established, you know, residences with plenty of vegetation.
Right. So you could plant arborvitae that are that size, and believe me, they're going to be adequate to screen within a couple of years.
And really, a fence is really, hopefully, what people put up to hide their stuff.
I would be happy with vegetation taken out, so they do have to do a fence, but, you know.
Why don't we just put adequate vegetation, and then you can determine what's adequate or not. You think those little things aren't adequate. Yeah.
Well, we're seeing...
It's not going to be a screen.
Well, we're seeing screen from view. It already says that.
That's what I'm saying, is if it's a little two-foot...
Plant, that's not a screen. You know, you're not going to hit everything on the head. You're not going to fix every problem. You're just going to try to let, and for the most part, hopefully it all flows and works. You're always going to get that one that says, well, isn't this what it means? You know, you're going to get the fighter, you know.
That's why we're trying to make things a little bit clearer for everybody. So
if
I
get more people coming in for permits and 90% compliance, I'm going to be a happy guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you're going to give them a permit at 90%?
What's that?
You know,
we're
getting 90%. You're real close, sir.
90% compliance once I get a permit from us.
You know, this is just going to clean this up a little bit so people don't walk out of the office and run away scared. Yep. You know, maybe they'll want to do it a little more. That's all this is about, really.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's coming up ahead of time, so then Nanette's not going out and saying, oh, by the way, I mean, we're trying to tell them up front is, we'd love to have you in our county, we'd love to have you doing business. Here are a couple things that we want you to address before you do it. Whereas people have been going
in residential areas
right now. And then she comes along and she's the bad girl.
One of the things that we're trying to do, a bit of a distraction here, but... or detraction, but one of the things that we're trying to do with, like, our medical hardship folks when they come in for, you know, medical hardship trailer on the property or accessory structure and grandma's going to come live with them, that kind of thing, is to pull them away from the front counter and do a 5 to 10 minute sit down with them, walk them through everything. We're actually going to hand them a folder with all their materials in it with a renewal date printed on the outside so they know, this is my home occ folder. I met with the planner. I've got Valerie's card. I can call her up if I have questions, that sort of thing. And I think we're going to, administratively at this permit counter, do the same thing for home occupations. We'll have the forms online. We'll have the information online. But to come in and actually file for the permit, I'm going to encourage them to step in the conference room. Let's sit down, talk about your business, much the way that you probably do those kind of initial consultations at the SBDC. And walk them through the ordinance, and let's talk about whether you're type 1, type 2, type 3, here's the permit, here's what you do. What are your future plans? I always ask them, where do you think you're going to be 5 years from now? Because why don't you put that in your permit for now, because you may grow faster than you think, hopefully.
And you come see me and run the building.
And I'm going to apologize, because I meant to have site plan review standard 22.050A, and I did not make that copy for everybody.
I just wrote it down here. Can we have copies?
Yeah.
You have a copy. Because you have a code. You're a planning commission. Yeah. You sleep in
this. Do you have one of those?
Sure. Yeah.
Somewhere.
That we can't answer. But they're very basic standards that have to do with access, impacts to infrastructure. I've already closed.
Water and sewage.
Well, it is, let me pull it up, I'll do a brief. Development standards contained within this code and all other applicable master plans, rules, resolutions, ordinances, codes, technical manuals, and policies of the county or the state or federal government. So that means if they're going to build a structure to do a a home business in and there's wetlands there, then they're going to need to go through the process of getting permission from DSL.
Right.
Okay. The Josephine County Roadway and Traffic Management Plan, including the official street map, standards for construction of required infrastructure and public facilities, and adequate access standards contained in 11.030.
Have an access permit from Public Works. If your home business has a bathroom in it, hook it up to the septic tank and get your DEQ permit.
That's all real basic.
Is that just not a traffic? Did you say traffic review too? Is that what?
Well, no. I mean, that doesn't mean that there's going to be a traffic review required by any means. What it does.
You're not
going
to generate enough trips.
Right. I mean, typically, it's an access permit is what Public Works is going to chime in on. Now, if they are taking access off of an easement, or if it's a private road with a maintenance agreement, then those things are going to come into play.
Yeah. Because that would be one thing that. It's going to be interesting when we have this discussion on road standards with private roads and private access permits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that's going to play out, frankly, because road maintenance agreements are they're hard enough to get everybody to agree and pay their annual fee and all that kind of stuff. They're even worse when somebody's got a business on it, and then you know the guy down at this end of the road says, geez, you know, I'm paying for all this road maintenance. I only have to go, you know, 150 feet to get to the county road.
Difficult.
The guy that's beating up my road is the one that lives three houses up that's got the appliance repair business going, and these big trucks come in there and beat up the road all the time. I mean, that...
Absolutely, yeah. It's going to be almost impossible to get that thing fine-tuned.
You know, I think that you and Vivian kind of have an advantage when we talk about road standards in our public hearing coming up on the 16th, because you're also thinking about home occupations and how they might impact a private road. Because that's going to be true.
I've got a little private road in my neighborhood that's a dirt road, literally. And you have to go over a bridge over an irrigation ditch that isn't really wide enough for a fire truck, you know. And when I was thinking the RLDC, the things they're talking about, the fire department, getting places,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking about those two homes. They're lost. You know, there's no way a fire truck's going to get across there.
Yeah.
And one of them is a builder of furniture that's back there, and he runs a home business. He builds his furniture and takes it down to the growers market.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe even address that.
But our development standards are pretty much focused on our ordinances, our codes, our public road standards, public access permits, that sort of thing. It does make reference to the roadway and traffic management plan, including the official street map. Home businesses are not going to generate enough traffic to even really affect it. But you'll need if you're going to access a county road with a new driveway that's just for the business, let's say, or for parking for the business, then you get an access permit. That would be an example of how we implement that.
Question. I just, thinking or looking at this, up to 4 non-resident employees and volunteers, including part-time, and I already got wife and my 2 kids working in the business. So what point do we say there's a health issue on toilet facilities or anything else for running a business out of the house? Because now you have public coming to the house too.
With the notice that we send out, because type 2s are going to be noticed to the neighbors, it goes to public health too, and DEQ.
Okay. I know we never really stressed that before, but
somebody's got an adequate septic system, fine. If DEQ says, if you're going to have 3 employees at the house as well all day, you don't have enough drain field. Extend your lines by another, 40 feet or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that they can't do it. It's just that they got to respond to the impact that they're creating.
Okay. So that would be part of the application too. That automatically goes to the health department. Says, oh, by the way, you're having the public come to your house,
right?
Are you doing a full pre-app? Is it a pre-app we're doing on these two? Is not?
Well, it's basically at the same
level as that.
No, okay. So type 1 would be more of the pre-app type level, and then type 2 is going to be more of a site plan review, but kind of reduced because we're going to do a site plan. We're going to do a site visit and public notice.
Okay.
So the planner is actually going to go on site and say, yes, you have adequate screening. Yes, 100 feet from the property line is going to give you enough distance from that house so that, if you're the dog that you're training is barking, you know, it's not going to become an issue for your neighbor.
But where is that David would be the final word on type 1, the decision was so type 1, type 2, did we say that last meeting?
They're all planner-directed decisions.
The issue then, so okay, we need to go to really type 2.
Right, well, when they come in with their application, they should have enough information at that point.
Okay.
Where we're aware, and they should be aware of what level they're coming in. And that's part of the point of having a small meeting beforehand,
gotcha,
is to have that discussion with them and help them determine where they're at.
Gotcha. Okay.
So they're going to be like, I don't know, is there going to be like a little list next to say where it says type 2 home occupations that sort of bullet what your requirements are? Like you're going to have a site visit, you're going to have a public notice,
members
are going to be noticed, and you're going to have a permit fee of X dollars.
It's here in the code, and then our applications are usually pretty explanatory of what you're being held to and what you are required to submit and what the review process will be.
Okay, and pull it out so it's very easy to find.
We don't have applications made up yet because this hasn't been approved, and we won't take that step until then. If you've looked at our applications, they are very detailed.
Yeah. Okay. We'll probably be, I think what you're looking for is detailed, but at the same time, keep it simple.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the push on all the application forms that we're doing. Okay. We've not revamped all of them yet. We've done a few of them that way. We're heading toward doing all of them. So simple application form, a checklist of some sort, bullet points, whatever you want to call it. And then if people want, hand them the code, hand them the rule of law. A lot of people aren't really going to read through this whole thing. What they want to know is, for my business, what counts? Well, if you're a type 2, here's your checklist.
Okay, are we done with type 2? Or is there more on the next page?
Well, it talks about the permit procedures, that it's quasi-judicial, and that the site plan review per Article 42 at a technical review level, there will be public notice, there will be a site visit, and there may be additional conditions determining what those impacts are and what type of issues are brought up by the neighbors during public notice, and a development permit is the final authorization.
And a word on that real quick for those that aren't, that haven't seen a lot of this level of administrative permit. A comment from a neighbor does not necessarily a condition make. Hear it from three or four neighbors, you probably get to see that. But again, we kind of apply that reasonable person standard. You may have one neighbor that says, you know, I just don't like the fact that business is going in there at all. That's not going to kill a permit.
No.
If he says, you know, I'm okay with it if he had some vegetation, I just didn't have to look at those trucks every day, that's probably a reasonable thing. And part of what happens in an administrative context that is more difficult to do in a public hearing is that we can sit down with that owner and say, you know, here's some conditions that we're looking at to mitigate some of the comments we got from owners. Let's work out what works for you here. You know, it's easier for you to put up a fence than it is to go out there and prune hedges and, you know, put in the weed killer and cut out the blackberries and all that kind of stuff. Do you want to put up a fence instead of vegetative screen? Because that might work better for you. And they're not necessarily, it's a bit of a negotiation, and then the conditions of approval can be something that you've already worked out that he can do.
Right.
Okay, so on number 5, where it says the planning director may impose additional conditions upon the approval of a type 2, can we explain why?
That's just what David explained.
Yeah, you did explain it, but can we put it in here so that it's more user-friendly and people don't feel like they're being imposed upon by the planning department?
You want to change the wording from impose?
But I do.
Well, yes, but we don't want it to look like that.
The planning director may demand additional conditions, you know, as opposed to impose. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the planning director may apply additional conditions.
Like that.
Oh, God. not going to scare anybody with the word like a fly.
Additional conditions. Why would you apply additional conditions? Considering why to
ensure compliance with the requirements of the article. Right there. There it
because
is.
Because home occupations, as we discussed in the beginning, there's so many different types. There can be so many different things to consider.
Right.
You can't create boilerplate type conditions for every situation.
You said that's what you wanted to do.
I got a guy that wants to sell reloading supplies.
Powder.
And now I got a gal next door who wants to do daycare. Do I want the reloading supplies on the side of the house that's over by the daycare? No. Can those businesses coexist?
Yeah.
Probably. My condition might be reloading supplies need to be stored on the west side of the house.
Right. That makes sense.
So that it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, those are what you see in conditions. And yes, they do impose them. But you could say apply. That's fine.
Would require be better?
I like apply.
Apply is fine.
And to say, I don't know, don't think I'm being dumb here. Okay, it is kind of dumb, but okay. The planning director may impose additional conditions upon approval of type 2 home occupation permits to ensure compliance. But rather than say to ensure compliance, just explain why. Permits to possibly mitigate neighbor concerns or safety concerns to ensure compliance with the requirements of this article. Can we make you look like an ice bag?
But then is that all? You know, if you put something on there, then people say, well, that's all he's got to look for. But then if he does more, then they're going to say, well, wait a minute.
Okay, well, then put it in parentheses and put IE. Like, possibly he would be mitigating neighbor concerns or safety concerns.
Okay.
IE.
Valerie, make a note. We'll move on.
Mine's getting too wordy now.
You should see the 17-page cell tower one.
I don't want to
go there.
I thought you might like this.
Yeah, I'm aiming for 17,
Dave.
Come on.
Right.
Fine.
You're right.
I tell you, people complain about that ordinance when they gave me the wireless ordinance in Vancouver and said, fix this. 62 pages.
Is that right?
And they said, here, fix this.
It was about 24 when I left.
There's also the possibility of putting that portion of the of describing what the conditions are for in the explanation, like because that's where we have it for CUPs, and it says that the conditions are created in order to mitigate any type of impact to the neighborhood. So we could put it in our description or in our definition also.
And that could be it. And that right there might be good language, which I think satisfies the concern Vivian has.
I'm just trying to make Dave look like a good guy. That's all. I just want the county to look like a good guy.
Don't try so hard.
No, really. I think it's much, when we first started this, one of our priorities was to make this user-friendly and to make people unafraid.
Yeah.
And so if we say impose and if we say, you know, he's in a do this, and you know, we're going to give Dave a crown and a power. You know, let's say why he's going to do it because you know, we want to be safe and we want neighbors' concerns to be addressed.
There's a phrase you just used at the end of that.
That conditions are applied in order to mitigate potential impacts to the neighborhood.
Yeah, but you
write that down before you forget it.
I think CUP.
That's where I'm pulling it from. Again, those are just words that scare people to me. You can fit in a nicer way. Okay, Dave, over there.
We're
going
to make sure that you plant bushes so that no one has to worry about what you're doing over here.
Anyway, it's a lot of them. So just ask the planner.
Can your decision be appealed on this? If
what's that?
Can your decision that you make can be appealed?
Any planner director decision can be appealed.
Okay.
It's at the end.
Then I get real nasty.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'll just make a note about mitigating impacts, and we'll find a nice way to say it that it is.
Possible, mitigate possible neighbor concerns or safety concerns, i.e.
So it brings it up twice in the explanation of a conditional use permit. It is therefore the policy of this code to permit conditional uses when significant impacts can be adequately mitigated through conditions of approval. And then it's also mentioned as It is also recognized that conditional uses may result in adverse impact on nearby properties. The
she
wants
it
intended to meet the
she wants it in plain people speak, though.
Yeah. You know, well, one of our county board of supervisors, county board of commissioners, the current one, said recently that the mental level of the people of Josephine County is a fifth grade. So I think we should at least address seventh grade. You know, because I think he's wrong on that, but, you know.
Not too much.
Okay, well.
I think there's pockets, but I...
Okay, so. So let's try to make it as user-friendly as possible, is all I'm saying. There's much explanation.
The planning director likes to mitigate adverse impacts to the neighborhood because we are not just writing this for the home business owner, we're also writing for the neighborhood. And we need to kind of keep going back to that. But if you think safety or neighborhood concerns is, we'll wordsmith them.
Yeah.
Throw it in there.
Okay.
Want to
move it on to
type
three now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're going to type three. It's quarter after seven.
Okay, so type threes are basically going to be anything that is above the standards contained in type two. And then there's also a list of certain businesses that would only be considered as a type three. That's because of the type of impact that they have. And we have commented in there that they either have to be reviewed as a conditional use permit or must be conducted as a use in a commercial or industrial zone.
Where does it say that?
In A.
Okay, as a use in commercial or industrial zone. Include the following items.
I have one to add.
Mm-hmm.
Auto, mobile home, recreational vehicle sales.
I think that's a good one to put there.
I think we discussed that earlier in our
debate. So number five, is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that should be automobile or RV sales.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to
I agree with that.
Define a level of that, though? Because we have a current applicant that just came in. Apparently, there's been a change in the DMV rules. Ward, you might be aware of this. It used to be that you could sell, what is it, up to three cars a year or something like that?
And that's one.
And you didn't have to have a DMV license? It's
mm-hmm.
now one.
It's one, right.
So Mr. Bobo, is his name, came in and filled out a home occupation permit. And what he does is fix up a car and sell one. Fix up a car and sell one at a time. They're in his garage. That's the only place he keeps them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he doesn't even sell them on site. He takes them to his business and parks them out in the parking lot where he works with the for sale sign at, and that's how he sells them. And he puts them on Craigslist. So if we're talking about those kind of uses, maybe we pick a number at which you're a type three. And then there's another number at which you could be a type one or two.
Although I would say that there's also a difference between having two cars for sale on your property and having two mobile homes or two RVs
mm-hmm.
on your property.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would think that any mobile home or RV sales should be.
Well, they can't have a mobile home.
Mobile homes are a little different, but RVs, I think they can truly sell off their property with no problem. So
yeah. That's
no impact. No, they could have a couple there. I mean, that's not going to hurt nothing. I mean, they're clean as long as they're, you know.
As long as their tires aren't flat and the weeds aren't little.
No, we're not talking about, you know
yeah.
Maybe there could be a.
But it could be three or more, or you're four or more.
Right.
Well,
then
you're a car lot.
Right.
Yeah. And then you're a type three.
Even in this commercial auto repair, I really truly believe that a guy could operate out of his house without impact any neighbors or any problem at all.
Take a drive around the county.
Oh, I know. We got Malay and we got other people that have totally pushed the limit. But then we got other people that I can guarantee you, I know 20 more auto repair shops you don't even know about. And they do a good job and they're great mechanics. And so I think that is really, truly, you know, Malay and a few of these other people they push the limit. They are out there.
There's a lot of them,
But on the other hand, I know tons more than aren't that you don't even know about. I mean, they're really good mechanics, you know. So, same thing with auto body shops. There's a million of them out in this
this county, they do a great job, and there's a few out there that are totally...
In residential areas, so we obviously are missing all of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I know a ton of them, you know, because that's where we take our cars to get fixed. I mean, you know, it's what we got to do, so... But with that being said, I mean, they don't hurt anybody. They're out in the county. They're working. They have nice shops. They have nice spray booths, and, you know... So I think there's some room here to wiggle here with some of this stuff that... And I don't see auto body repair shop in here anyway as prohibited, but
auto restoration services we included.
Where's that at?
Four.
I think when we talk about it, it's you just like you said, there's guys in the lot with the word compliance. Because we've got a guy behind us that's got an auto body shop that there's no scrubbers, there's no nothing to insulation from the sound, so when he's out there painting we can smell it. We can hear the air tools.
And that's not right.
So
see that?
I guess the verdict should be as if it's prohibited, or is it based on compliance?
On compliance. I would say on compliance.
Well,
if you can hear
neighbors.
If you can smell it and hear it, I can hear it or smell it from my house. That's not, it shouldn't be allowed. I mean, as far as I'm concerned.
You're doing your barbecue in the backyard and all of a sudden.
Right.
You're guests are killing others.
Well, even down here, you know, I have a shop by the, you know, by the cabinet shop here in town, and every afternoon I smell after fumes on, you know, Ann Street. The whole place is filled up, and that's from Master Brand.
Yep.
They get away with it. They've done it since the beginning of time, and, you know, it's just not good. But it's a commercial zone and commercial application.
Not in with a bunch of houses.
So, but I think, I mean, even auto repair shops, I think the commercial auto repair, I think that should be they're taken out of here completely, and you know, not under prohibited uses. I think that should be allowed in the type three.
Could we agree that, so you think it's just a type three?
Yeah, I think it could
as long as they, type three, providing they meet all compliance.
So it's CUP.
Yeah, and it could even be a type two if it's under so many cars and stuff too. You know, that really could be moved into another category completely. I mean, I really think it should be prohibited uses. It shouldn't be in there at all. It should be at least type three if it's a commercial or more than so many cars, and if not, it could even be a type two because you know what?
What's the threshold?
You know, two cars maybe outside storage or two cars working at a time or something, you know?
I think I hear five miles probably because he does one at a time could be a type two. I mean, there's no impact. The cars are hidden from the neighbors or anything else.
Yeah.
It could be the type two.
No small plants.
So, you know, and then we get with other people we know, as Annette said, and, you know, they have, you know, 20 cars outside their shop, and it's a mess, and stuff's piled up everywhere. I mean, it's not right.
And we're probably not going to, prove that as a CUP or a type 3. I mean, that's it. I mean, the limit's going to be what the property can hold and what it can really bear. And the thing about a conditional use permit, and I think we had some discussion of conditional use permits earlier in the process, but it's a use that can normally be located in that zone given certain conditions.
Right.
Churches and schools are classic conditional uses because in a residential neighborhood, a school fits, but not if, in some neighborhoods, if you've got, you know, loudspeakers ringing a field and you're broadcasting at 90 decibels and you have rock concerts for the students in the field next to a residential neighborhood. That's
Sunday,
not a
you hold church there and there are 90 million cars there.
Yeah.
That's like the Fruitdale School.
But it's okay if you got adequate parking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where some people operate within the bounds and that's fine and some people don't. And that's where type 3 and CUPs really give you the flexibility to condition them depending upon the property. We're on 30 acres and the business is well screened and it's within the middle of it. Mm-hmm. You could probably work on 5-6 cars at a time and nobody's going to know it.
No, and you're right.
But if the same business were to be on a 1.5-acre parcel.
Right.
Next to Rogue River Highway or something like that, where they've got poor access or they're on a curve where there's traffic coming in and out.
Yeah, okay, so on number 5, though, in A, type 3, we should probably have
auto mobile home RV sales.
Mobile home, not even there, because that should be under prohibited, right?
Yeah. Auto RV sales excessive to the time?
Sales.
Prohibited.
mobile home sales under prohibited, because we're not going to approve that.
Well, and our
but auto and RV sales up to,
which is good,
two at a time.
That's fine.
And commercial auto repair for two at a time. And then put anything over that as prohibited, and anything over the auto and recreational vehicle sales over two is prohibited.
Okay, I thought we were doing anything over two at a time was a CUP, and then a type two is two and two.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Only that is a type two.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then up there,
two or under is a type two.
Yeah.
Right. Three and over is a type three.
Yeah.
Up to.
Yeah. Up to 6 or something. Well, or whatever.
I don't know if you can do that with conditions. Yes, that's right. So over three, if you're subject to conditional use permit, I think that's fair. So we'll take that completely out of here. So the two are vehicle, two or three? Is it two allowed and two? Two and a two and above is a three. Okay, so would that be under type two, make it number seven, that auto and RV sales in excess of two at a time?
Yeah.
Or limited to
two
at a time.
Well, it would be number two. It would probably go up higher because you got the definition
yeah.
of
right.
him.
We'll just add it in there, but less than or equal to two
right.
vehicles. And that's repair.
And
repair
auto repair.
Sales.
Yeah, right.
Auto repair over two at a time. Or...
sales and repair.
Limited to two
at a time.
And where is that going?
Under B, type two.
A, type two.
Yeah. A, okay.
It'll be A. B is for procedures.
Right.
Okay.
And that's
92.
I like the way that Valerie led this out too, having the definition of what the standards are and then the permit procedures in a separate section that works real cleanly. By the way, I want to give a quick kudo to my staff person here because Valerie's never written a code before. This is the first one she's done. So I think she's
very good.
It does
on
the slow.
Thank you.
It's
all right.
Okay, moving on.
All right, so if we
were going to
prohibited uses. I think we covered those.
Mm-hmm.
Next page, similar
information. I'm not sure about prohibited. What do we have?
Do that again.
Okay.
I think we just learned
shop and salvage, storage and sale, fireworks, and mobile home sales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one, two, three.
How about the breeding of large hoofed animals?
Actually, that's a farm use and they're allowed outright.
Outright. In the city and residential?
Special I have no idea what they allow in the city.
Especially in your neighborhood.
In residential, they can have a farm use.
Okay, somebody can check my neighborhood.
Oh, I've been out to a place and she had like 25 geese and about 15 sheep.
Oh, no, these people got two horses in their backyard, which when the other neighbor looks out their back window, they see a horse, And
that was
E-I-E-I-O. Okay, moving on. Yeah,
okay.
You're
not
talking about my neighbor, are you?
Huh?
The pants, my neighbor?
No, I was talking about the person who lived behind us for a while that had a horse. And I looked out my kitchen window and it was there eating my ivy off the fence.
Okay. So this section is in order to clarify because there are certain types of businesses that aren't actually considered home occupations and they're allowed outright because they're considered an agricultural use, such as a farm stand. There are also certain forced, if you were taking firewood from your large piece of property and selling it, that's an outright use. So there's certain uses that are farm and forest that they don't need to go through a review for, and I wanted to make that clear. And then, as far as we had talked about garage sales, and then there's also estate sales. I think auctions should be in here too, probably, because those happen, especially with foreclosures occurring.
Well, won't the county be in violation of that all the time? Oh no, they go to the courthouse.
So basically excluding garage sales with just some minimal type of restrictions so that it doesn't become a full-time business garage sale. 4 days in duration and 6 times in a year.
Is this out of the code we have right now?
No, we don't specify that in our current.
Oh, you don't. Okay, so this is all new.
Mm-hmm.
New
right. This, as you can see,
that's actually one of the things that the home occupations. That's one of the reasons this whole thing came about. When does a garage sale become a secondhand business?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because we had a couple people on.
Yeah. And so we. Yeah. This was a committee. Rick was in on that one, and I'm not sure if you were at that discussion board, but that, yeah, we toyed around with how many garage sales is sort of a. I know it's a touchy subject.
Because garage sales are really big in this town.
They are.
They are. And we don't want to do away with them, but we want to sort of define the difference between a garage sale and a secondhand store.
It's a tough go here because I know there's many people that actually depend on garage sales to make enough money to get their extra bills paid and to make a living with.
Well, these numbers are
flexible. People are actually business people because they're going out to other garage sales buying materials and bringing it back to their garage.
Yeah, it's not really a garage sale.
They're a secondhand shop.
So at that point, that where it goes back into a type 2 or type 1 type business.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that the 4 days in duration is good. If you guys think that 6 is...
No, 4 is...
About 3 days in duration occur not more than 12 times in any given calendar year. That'll at least let them make their monthly bills.
Yeah. So do you guys think we should do it more times in a year?
So then...
But then...
But that's not a garage sale. Nobody knows that most stuff.
You'd be surprised. Let me show you my storage units.
No, it's see here.
Even if you say
that's the threshold that we talked about before. I don't know if you were there at that meeting, Dave. Were you there at that meeting where we talked about this threshold? We spent 20 minutes on this.
Yep.
So that's the threshold that came out of the meeting. So
we beat it to death. So.
Which means
4 days is okay. The 4 days in duration because something I do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday sale. And,
yeah. And typically they only do 2 or 3 anyways. It's, I mean, the 4 is being generous.
Let's change the 6 to 8 though because that's the amount of months here that are halfway decent somebody could be out there selling because they don't see yard sales during the 4 really harsh winter.
This is April through October.
You see them every single day of every single year here. Just any day you open.
Well, I think it's reasonable for them.
Do you guys want to change the 8 to 6 or 8? We still have an outline to go through too on our applications.
12 times a year.
What's the definition? This is the big definition of a yard sale versus a garage sale. Guy's got a garage sale, stuff is there in the garage.
Yard sale.
All over the goddamn place.
Yeah, there's no difference.
We're not making any distinction there.
Yeah, let's say they start, you know, basically they're going to start having yard sales this month is when it really starts. This month, the next month.
Yeah.
And it goes on all the way through October, really. So if they did 2 a month, what's that? Is that 12? 12 or so? 12, 13, 14?
16.
16. So if you did, you know, we don't want to limit. I don't want people to get depressed if they can't go sell their junk and make a few extra dollars. That's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. They're really not hurting anybody. People love it. It's something.
But you got to multiply the number of times 4
mm-hmm.
because they can have it for 4 days. 8 times or 12 times or 20 times.
I don't know anybody that does it. So
I don't.
On a Wednesday. They still usually start Friday.
Right,
Saturday.
Three.
Saturday.
So let's
have a little vote here. What do you want? Does anybody want to change it?
I would
yes.
Say,
okay.
Yeah, I want to change it.
So would you want to change it to 12, 8, or 10?
Are we talking about times a year?
Yeah.
I say 12.
Okay. I say 8.
I say 8.
I don't vote.
12.
I would do 12. I mean, I think that.
How about 10? Middle ground.
Well,
you don't vote.
I know. I'm giving middle ground. I'm not voting.
Yeah.
I'm giving the middle ground.
12.
Yeah. Between 8 and 12. 10.
12. 12 maximum. Can we just put 12 maximum?
It's voted.
Okay.
So we got two 12s and
two. Two 12s and two 8s, and that's why I said 10.
So that's, you divide that half, it comes to 10.
So, yeah. So let's do 10. Oh, we're okay with that. Okay, voted on.
So that's 10, 40 days a year.
And we're good. So that's
they can sell. Okay.
And you did take the 4 days and make it 3, weren't you?
Yeah, 10, 3.
Well, I was saying 3.
Who's going to keep track?
Exactly.
Okay. So, you know,
this is just for when, basically, right. When I get a complaint and I have to go out there
right.
And say.
And that's what it's for. So, mm-hmm. You know, exactly. If they're not hurting anybody and they have 11, who cares? Or, but you know what I'm saying?
No, unless somebody complains.
Monday through Friday.
Because there are a lot of people that just have it. I mean, I've been on several. Mm-hmm. You know, they just keep it out there and they even have open and close signs.
It's
in Korea,
and
a little,
yeah.
You know.
It's a business.
Yeah.
Okay, can we add in where it says garage sales? Can we put yard sales in there too so that
yard slash garage sales?
Yeah, so they make no distinction about that because that goes on lockdown where I came from. People stopped getting garage sale permits because you had to pull a permit down there to have a garage sale. And then they started calling it yard sales and they didn't have to get a permit.
Huh.
So was it covered.
Okay.
That, it
worked
that way down
so
there.
So creative. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I go back on the farm stand thing? Because this came up with a question last year with a guy that has a small farm. I think it's out on the Upper River Road or Lower River Road. Part of that area that was urban growth, but the question being is what can he sell from the farm as produce from his own property and no packaged goods?
Right.
Okay, is that in that part of that code?
It in the code that's referenced, that's where you would find the details of that approval.
Okay. All right.
Or the standards for that.
So everything off his own property only, period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, then when it comes to renewal, the only big change that we've put in here is that rather than having to renew it the first year that you're in business, you've got a two-year period
right.
Before you actually have to go through a renewal.
All right, we talked about that.
Before. Right.
What is the cost of that? Do we have a cost?
We don't have a cost. Right now it's $125.
No.
And there's a review that's involved also. Because they have,
things have changed.
They do a checklist.
They do a checklist saying that they're doing the exact same thing that they were approved for.
Okay. Right.
And it's reviewed by a planner. And so typically those kind of reviews do come in at $125.
And when you say review, you go out and review? You go out and look?
No, that would be a site visit.
Okay. So is there an additional charge for a site visit?
Once in a while we do. In fact, I did a site visit on one that came in for a renewal, and there were some changes to it, and I wanted to see for myself, and I just rode past it on my bike and did a site visit.
So it's just kind of a rant. It's not a negative. It's a rant.
Yeah.
It
kind of depends upon that kind of business, too.
Yeah.
In this particular case, they had added one unit. To a bed and breakfast, they were still below the threshold of 5,
mm-hmm.
But their original permit had been written for 3. This is up to 4, so compliant with the code, but not necessarily with the original permit that was written.
Okay, so
is that a big deal? No, because they're still under 5.
No, let me ask: type ones are still are charged the same as type threes and twos?
No.
No.
Okay, type one is charged
well,
how much?
Well, we're going to move on to home occupation application outline. So this is just going to kind of outline the basic requirements for the review, the amount of time spent, the cost, the suggested cost, and also what's brought out of that review or what's going to be created from that review. So, for exempt, it's done by checklist, as we discussed. There's a signed compliance agreement by the applicant. It'll be maintained in a land use file and put into our laser fish. We're going to try to do that over the counter, although if we have a really busy counter, it may be something where we're going to have to review it and then come back and say, okay, come back in and we'll, how do you sign this? There is no annual review. There is no development permit. Our average staff per hour cost is $75. This should take us probably less than an hour, but we're also creating a file. So that's, and it will include an interview with the applicant.
So about an hour is what we're looking at. Total time in.
Now, my question is, if we're already paying taxes to support, and don't be offended, please, to support the planning office, the planning office is paid for by taxes, why are we charging someone?
Give me money from the general fund and I won't argue.
We're not collecting enough taxes to pay for the cost.
Your fees.
Basically, the planning office operates on it. If you use us, you are paying for that use because we do not have the fees to cover our expenses.
We're not a self-supporting department.
Right now, like this exercise in writing an ordinance at the behest of the Planning Commission and the Board of Commissioners, the taxpayers are paying for it. And individual homeowners or individual business owners are not. But our department's 75% fee funded right now. As development has gone down, however, customer contacts at the front counter have gone up, by the way. We got to pay to keep the front counter open. And I just want to remind you, these figures aren't set in stone. And that's part of the fee ordinance piece that goes to the Board of Commissioners. And that's really where they get involved. They, when the Planning Commission comes up with the ordinance, your ordinance is not going to include numbers. It can include a recommendation, but the board, that'll be actually a separate ordinance. Do fee ordinance separate from the provisions of the you know, all the regulations. And the reason we do that is that you can easily tweak those fees, and you go back to a fee schedule every year, even though your RLDC doesn't change. You can tweak the fees as you need to cover costs.
But if you look at this, they're only paying $75 one time. They don't have to pay any renewal.
And one other note there too, Vivian, and I can't tell you the year that this occurred, but and I don't know the current mindset of county commissioners now, but it was directed by the Board of County Commissioners that the planning office become fully fee funded.
That was Harold Howie and I actually did that a year ago.
And he's interestingly enough, he's kind of changed his mind.
He has, yes.
Yeah, and I've talked to him recently about that. But the degree to which any department is fee funded or general fund, which is shrinking, is a question that we're all struggling with right now. So I don't want to. That's a bigger discussion that
we can solve
here. But our general gist in looking at these, and that's why we put in the time that we're anticipating of review, multiplied it by our average rate for staff time, and that's a loaded time. So that's a blend of Valerie's time and director's time somewhere in the middle between salary benefits and what it costs to keep us in moccasins. So go ahead, Valerie.
Okay. So a type one is a ministerial application. The requirements will be the checklist, which are the standards that we read in the code. Statement of operations. So basically, you're going to be, the applicant would make a statement of what their business plan was, what they're doing, how many employees, hours of business, where are they doing it, and they're going to do a plot plan showing us where their sign's going to go, where their adequate parking is, what part of what structure they're using, etc. Most of the standards that we've pulled for type 1 come from the ORS 215-448, which you have a copy of. From this review, the applicant will receive a written decision with standard conditions. There is an annual renewal. The time would be approximately 3 to 4 hours, so that 3 to 4 hours at $75 an hour. Now, this is what we are doing differently, and we don't do this in any other application. The cost that's being proposed is $375, which, as Ward knows, is our pre-application fee. Included in that fee is your development permit. Your development permit typically would be $275. So you're getting your development permit, you're paying another $100 for a review, that's taking 3 to 4 hours. That's an extremely fair deal. In my humble opinion.
And those standard conditions, one of those will probably be, The ministerial application, sometimes you think, well, how do you write conditions that are standardized, that aren't subjective, and that are a custom fit? How do you do that? And first condition is always going to be substantial conformance with the site plan as approved. Mm-hmm. So in that conversation that we work out, okay, Mr. Ockenden, you know, your business looks good, but gosh, you know, can we screen that right there? Because you put up some screening. Okay, yeah, I could do that. And you put the screening on your site plan. Mm-hmm. I just reference your site plan. So whatever you told me you're going to do there, do it. Mm-hmm. You're good to go. And that's the that's the way you customize a otherwise ministerial permit.
Right. Right. Okay, good.
And each one of these little packets that you're going to give people for this, does it have a list of descriptions of what, like, weight? Quasi-judicial means and ministerial review, what does that mean?
We're
talking fifth grade here. Right.
Typically, we have something in there that describes the review process. And right. So that would be included for each level.
With definitions.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I personally don't think that the people in Josephine County have a fifth grade or a seventh grade. I think they're a lot smarter than that.
A 30-second description of the difference between ministerial and quasi-judicial. When I tell them this is objective standards, they don't change. And these, we make up some standards and it's subjective. Most people understand that.
I'm sorry, I was laughing. People were laughing. I didn't hear you.
It's okay.
There'll be an explanation in the Okay. Type 2, technical review, site plan review. This is a quasi-judicial review. Public notice and site visit are included. These are items that go over the ORS threshold, which also brings into play the fact that this ORS is applicable, the standards are applicable to resource lands. So once you get into this level of review, if you are on resource property, there might be a little bit more restriction than you would find if you were in a residential area.
Right, you've got to get more processing.
Right. It would include the site plan review standards of 42.050A that we went over. It would include mitigation for impact, and that would be through the conditions of approval. Mm-hmm. From this review, you would get a written decision with specific conditions. You would have an annual review. We are approximating about 8 to 10 hours, and that includes the site visit and putting together the notice. The cost at $650 has that same deal as the first one, where the $275 is including, the $650 is including your $275 development fee, which means that basically you're paying $375 for your review, and it includes your, and then you're getting your development permit on top of that.
The annual review is, didn't we just say 2 years? Is that what you're going to do?
No, the first review doesn't, the first annual review does not occur for 2 years, and then after that it's annual. I guess that your first review is not for 2 years, and then it's annual. How's that?
Why doesn't it just be every
2 years? We figured 2 years to kind of get the business off the ground.
I
think that, I don't know, a review a year from now, most home businesses take anywhere. Yeah, they
be very low impact.
Yeah, they're going to be very low impact for that first. It's once they really kind of get up and going. I think it takes a couple of years to really understand.
Yeah, business takes 18 to 24 months to even to break even.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah. Call it a
case. And I think we've heard that from Rick or you in the past, and that's kind of how we focused on it.
I just don't know if you couldn't do
that. Frankly, that's more work for my staff.
Forever. You know, I think 2 years should be the
biannual review.
Yeah.
Biannual review on
just
all of
continually
them. And that's a little
bit. Yeah, to save the extra, you know, just
every 2 years.
I think
could
so.
They possibly need building permits or anything like that? But maybe we should review it within a year and then 2 years after that.
Because it says if they change from their plan, they have to come in and notify you anyway. So, you know, they're obligated to make... You know, so.
So on type 1 and type 2, we're going to say biannual review. What do you think?
I have that to say that that's a good judgment call.
Okay.
Biannual? I'm okay with that.
So a type 3.
Can I go back?
Oh, sure.
This will affect type 2 here. When we look at the hours, this type
type 1 is 3 to 4 hours, type 2 is 8 to 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If I expected to come in today, 8 hours to 10 hours later, I should expect to get an answer back.
Oh, wrong, Mr. Kelly.
Well, that's what it says.
But don't think about 2 weeks.
Let me explain a couple of things. A ministerial application, such as our pre-application, our time frame for turnaround on those is typically 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
Site plan review, your notice period, you have a 15-day and a 12-day.
Okay.
So that's including the fact that a planner is putting you in with the files that are already on their desk, and everybody gets done according. So we try not to make promises that we can't keep.
That's why I'm wondering if it should state that really.
Well, this is just an outline.
Okay.
Well,
the hours.
That time doesn't have anything to do with how time you're.
It's how long time you guys spend on it.
Right.
I mean, the public sees this.
Yeah.
That five-year-old attitude.
This was to justify cost of the review.
You said that. You said.
I didn't say that. This outline is not going to be
handed out to people.
No. This is looking at how much time an application is going to take.
How much in-house time.
Right. For applications, we're not putting together applications at this point. We don't have an approved code.
Right.
So I'm trying to give a basic description of the process and the other things that are in there, a fee, time frame, required materials.
It has to be actual time?
Actual time.
And that's what land use fees are helping.
Okay.
Right.
And so we tried to identify what average time would be and then tie it to the billable hour.
Right.
How we came up with it.
Yeah. At the end of each day, I don't have one application that he's ready to approve. I wish I did. Okay, so type 3, conditional use permits, otherwise known as CUPs. We have the list of businesses that are going to be listed, and any proposals that exceed the allowed standards will be reviewed as a CUP. It includes public notice, site visit, and there's also the possibility of a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a staff report at the end of the review, a written decision with specific conditions, approximately 14 to 20 hours of review involved. This one will require a pre-application, and that's basically the level where we would determine if a hearing would be necessary for that.
They don't get their development fee included in that pre-application?
The pre-application, no. The pre-application would come before the CUP application
fee.
I'm sorry, that's not there. That would be 2,000. And that one, actually, I hadn't determined on that one because 14 to 20 hours at $2,000, I mean, that's fair, and especially then if you're looking at a hearing, I mean, that's a lot of staff time is involved in that. So that one I would need for...
14 to 20 and depends upon a hearing. I mean, for the big ones, contentious ones, we're going to lose money.
Right.
So I did not include the development permit in that fee. I think that when you get to the type 3 level, you are really doing some major
commercial.
Borderline, should you be in another zone.
Exactly.
And
right.
So you need to be willing to make that step and make that investment into your business.
Mm-hmm. That pre-app, too, is our opportunity to tell them you need to go to a commercial industrial zone.
Yeah.
And that pre-app's a lot of work. I mean, you put a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of information into one of those.
Anyway, these are guesstimates on how much time we're probably going to spend on these. They're based on our experience on other home occupations we've already looked at. And they're an attempt to capture costs from the customers. I like the biannual review, frankly. That's good.
That's work.
I think that's a good idea. The exempt level, I could probably even knock that down some. And I think it's still doable for us. I'd like to see a lot of folks come in under that exemption, but they're kind of in the file, and that's an opportunity to tell them, look, as your business grows, here's the levels that you're looking at permit wise. If you want to stay, good with the code and good with the community, one of the things that we've talked about in the past is that if you have a valid business permit, and most of these folks will have some limited liability insurance on the property, boy, you run a business and people come on your property and they know you've got a business, therefore the perception is that you've got money to burn, and if somebody falls and puts their ankle, you know, breaks their ankle or something like that, first thing the insurance company is going to look for is, does that business have a license? And if they don't, they're done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason, I think, to, those of us that own businesses, to be legit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, Ward said it pretty well, I think, in the first meeting. I think you talked about, you know, this is the entryway to really establishing a business. This is
right.
To be legit. And you're making that declaration that you're not just mowing lawns for a living. This is your business.
Right.
And to make that entry into being a business pretty easy, mm-hmm. frankly.
No, absolutely.
It's a whole lot easier than
buying
a commercial parcel and developing a, mm-hmm. a brick-and-mortar business on a commercial industrial piece. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that's what our freedom.
That's our goal.
Being American and being allowed to do things. So, you know, this is part of that green. Let's call
freer.
It the green.
Freer country.
Right,
so, heading back to a freer.
If society. Anything comes up for you guys that you know, if you read through it again and you know, something doesn't strike you as correct, feel free to email me and let me know what that is. Specify what you know what part of the code.
Well, like Shavana Finder, I will go back and retype the entire thing, make it into 17 pages, add several clauses, and really make it so simple that a fourth grader could understand.
So at this point, we probably don't need to meet again on this, I don't think. I mean, we got it.
Do we think we pretty much got it?
Yeah, I'm happy to make some changes and email the
final. I do that. We'll do an email meeting. Or
great.
Do you think if we need to actually
meet again, we can meet again, and we can all email each other. I think at this point, let's...
The next cell tower ordinance you have, would you let Valerie write it?
Well, I'm sure she'd be thrilled to do that. So that'd be fun, huh?
I'm sure Valerie wants to do that.
So, quick question, though, and I asked this on one of the first meetings we had, too. Now, we've got this all going forward now, you know, with new business and everything else. What kind of program going backwards to people who are already in business that haven't complied? Is it going to be kind of like any kind of MMC program, or how are we going to do this? So.
We have the current program that was approved by the Board of County Commissioners, where we are currently paying for the application process.
Yeah, and they blew it out, didn't they?
I know. Yes. So I don't know how many will come in.
It's on our system, and if they want to do it, they'll do it. If they don't, they're not going to do it. So we can't.
Yeah. Okay, but we're not going to be slapping people with penalties or fines or anything like that. Because,
No. When you come in here, if you have not been through Nanette and had a complaint, in order to go to Nanette, someone has to have a written complaint.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then it's a violation, and then there are some surcharges involved. However, if you come in of your own accord, say, listen, I've got this business, I've been doing it for 5 years, we're going to say, well, submit an application and we'll get you going. And it'll be all the normal costs that are involved. There's no
penalty. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's kind of an amnesty. We're not going to go back.
No, and that's the way it always is in here. If you came to me and said, you know, I built a new garage and no one reported you, then you're just going through the regular process. And the only issue would be, you know, can you meet the setbacks? You know, did you put it in the right spot?
It's easier to build and ask for forgiveness than it
sometimes
is to ask for it.
Sometimes, not always. Not always.
Well, I'm here.
Okay, adjourn
the meeting. That's adjourn the meeting? Yeah.